1888 Podcast Network.
I'm John Barrett Ingalls, and this is The How, The Why. Presented by 1888. Every week, we connect with artists, authors, and innovators in the world of publishing and literature to discuss their creative process and creative purpose, and explore the evolution of the industry. 1888 serves as a regional catalyst for the preservation, presentation, and promotion of cultural heritage and literary arts. Let's get connected. This episode was recorded live at 1888 Center by Brew Sessions Live. Thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight. This is the How the Why Live. My name is John Barrett Ingalls. Thank you for coming out to the 1888 Center. Today, it is my pleasure to have my second conversation with Jonathan Latham, author of Fortress of Solitude, author of Motherless Brooklyn, and author of, most recently, Gambler's Anatomy. Jonathan, thank you for joining us today.
You bet, and what a pleasure to be introduced to this remarkable space and atmosphere you've got here.
We're very lucky and very fortunate to have somebody of your caliber join us.
Great. Thank you. This is really a treat, and the whole publishing program and the everything you're doing is so much more tangible just by coming out here. It's a great argument for in-person experiences.
Absolutely. I mean, our first conversation, I've been doing this podcast for 4 years. You were pretty quick up on our my learning curve. And for anybody who's out here now or anyone who's listening at home, episode 80, we can listen in to our first conversation where we kind of like track your momentum from inception to where we are now. Today, I'd like to take a different approach. I want you to take your newest book, A Gambler's Anatomy, and I'd love to go through from conception to publication.
I love that idea, and I'll do my best to make sense of it. You know, of course, the accounts that writers offer after the fact is often, you know, a new fiction arises,
absolutely,
right? But I'll try to create an interesting one anyway.
Well, I'd love to start. You know, I'd love for you to tell our listeners a little bit about the book, and then I have a book related question about your process as well.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so how do I even account for the beginnings, the first inklings of Gambler's Anatomy? I mean, for me, a novel always waits. I might have an idea about characters or an idea about a setting or some kind of conceptual hijink or maybe a set piece I want to write or a voice that I'm excited about. But until I have a number of these elements already finding a relation one to the other, I don't feel like I can write a novel. So I can talk about, you know, I mean, for instance, a lot of this book was set in Berkeley, which was a place I lived all through my 20s. And specifically, Telegraph Avenue, I lived around the corner from a bookstore called Moe's where I worked. And so that atmosphere in the half mile of Telegraph Avenue that runs south from Sather Gate, it's a very storied area. It's a very colorful, strange environment. You know, it's where the free speech movement started. It's where People's Park is. But it's also a kind of a grubby, kind of half ruined, half gentrified commercial strip that everyone complains about. And it's full of very colorful homeless people, some of whom have gigantic personalities, and everyone recognizes them and knows their name and greets them. There was a famous guy who was the naked guy there for a long time when I was working there, and there was a poet named Julia Vinograd, and there was I'm forgetting what he was called, but there was a guy in a dress with a shopping cart and a beard who would scream at everyone. I think he was just called the Angry Man. And these were the pillars of the environment. They were the most celebrated personalities in Berkeley. And running a bookstore there, you know, I got this kind of up-close glimpse of the ruins of the 1960s Berkeley, which is still kind of embedded in amber. It's still sitting there to be fascinated by and even become involved with in some ways. And it had a lot of attractions for me. But if you're the one kind of kicking people out of the bookstore bathroom at 11 so you can close up the shop, you also see the undertow of that atmosphere. So this was an environment that I'd lived in, and it really was my life for a long time, and I hadn't employed it. So there's that. It's one element. It's just sort of sitting there. I've never used Berkeley. I've never tapped it. I've never really explored my, you know, fascination, ambivalence, amusement with that scene. So it's like, this is like a plate spinning act. So you think of me, I ran over to one side of the stage and I'm spinning this like Berkeley plate. Well, that's interesting. It's not a novel, but I've got this great setting. I've never, you know, and all these intimate impressions of it, I've never used it.
But Berkeley Berkeley was first.
I don't know if it was first. I just know it was kind of hanging there
sure.
for use. I'm going to circle back to it. I'm really going to try to honor your invitation to tell a whole story here. So that plate is spinning. I've always loved what I think of as, well, I mean, what other people think of as body horror. David Cronenberg is the outstanding example. Stories of characters who become in some way involved in the devastating compromise of their human boundary, you know, that whether it's some sort of disease or surgery or violent attack, you know, this sort of, I mean, a great example is Cronenberg's The Fly, when Jeff Goldblum's body parts begin falling off and he puts them in the medicine cabinet because he might want to use them later. And, I mean, Cronenberg has a lot of stories like this. And there's a great French film called Eyes Without a Face by the director Franju, a beautiful, entrancing, you know, black and white French film from the, I guess, late 50s or early 60s. In the middle of it, there's this surgical sequence where the mad surgeon kind of takes a woman's face off in order to put it on another woman's face. And it's just an unbelievable, unbearable kind of extended scene of body horror. And you know, you can think of a lot of examples. There's a Rock Hudson movie. John Frankenheimer filmed this short paranoiac novel called Seconds with Rock Hudson as a guy who pays to have his face remade, and he thinks it's going to be wonderful because a very ordinary looking man gets turned into Rock Hudson basically, but it doesn't work. He wants to reverse the surgery. He's unhappy as Rock Hudson. Of course, the whole thing is fantastic. You know, in retrospect, it seems like some sort of really wonderful allegorical story about Rock Hudson being in the closet, and so he's not happy being himself. But and I was thinking about my own interest in neurosurgery, but also in surgery generally. And I was thinking, I want to write about this violation of the human head or face. I've always thought a lot about brain surgery. Part of this is because my mother, when I was a kid, my mother underwent two gigantic brain surgeries, one that was successful and bought her an extra few years of life, and then a second that was unsuccessful, and she was never the same again after they closed her up. And I've always been interested and read about neurology, and that enters into various things I've written, obviously Motherless Brooklyn and Tourette's syndrome. And at the same time, I've had this interest in an idea. It's almost a joke, but it's one that hangs over a lot of my efforts. The idea, the emblem of the idea, is a joke that my my friend Maureen made when we were teenagers. She had this kind of cryptic saying she would pronounce. She would say, "You can't be deep without a surface," and I ended up using it as the keynote idea in a short, fairly antic novel, a kind of romantic comedy I wrote called "You Don't Love Me Yet," which was a book about people who are superficial. They're in their 20s, their late 20s, and they're trying to become a famous rock band, and they're very concerned with surfaces and appearances. And I was just interested in this whole puzzle of how we are, you know, we feel like we have depths, but what we present to the world are these kind of, you know, kabuki faces. We perform. And this tension between depth and surface in human personalities intrigues me. And I wrote once before in a book called Chronic City about a character who was felt himself to be fatally superficial. He was a child star. He didn't even grow up to be a regular actor because he wasn't a very good actor. He just basically slid through life on the power of his fame and his charm. And so I was also thinking about the difference between plastic surgery and brain surgery. You know, one is this sort of exalted, almost religious thing. Like, the surgeon who can go in and fix your brain, it seems almost like in a fairly secular society, they have the power of a kind of a priest or a philosopher king. You know, they go and they can alter the deep structures and preserve the deep structures of our intelligence and our humanity, and so they become revered. On the other hand, a plastic surgeon is a sort of like figure of contempt and superficiality. Like, they just, you know, change your face around. They try to smooth it out and make it prettier, and usually it doesn't work and it looks really bad. But actually, fundamentally, they're both doing the same thing. They're both just surgeons who like rework the flesh meat. Stuff, the meat. Yeah. They're just like, you know, really, really fancy, meat puppeteers or meat, what I don't know what it would be, seamstresses. So that joke or that problem of the ostensible depth of the brain surgery and the paltriness or the superficiality, the embarrassingness that we associate with surgery to the face, found its intersection in this idea for my book of body horror, which would be someone whose head has to be taken apart and put back together. So in effect, their surgeon becomes both their neurologist and their plastic surgeon. And, you know, what if the deep surgery is totally successful, but the trauma of having your face taken apart and put back together is something you can never recover from? I became really interested in this. Like, what if the surgeon says, "We did it, everything's great," and you're like, "I will never be the same again. You took away my essential self because you disarranged the outside of me." And so this goes into the "you can't be deep without a surface" kind of joke, right? So this is beginning to form for me. I was reading more about surgeons again. And, you know, one of the things that supports my whole conceit is brain surgeons are kind of, you know, assholes. They're not really very profound people. They're very arrogant people. And they can do one extraordinary thing, but they really are just exalted mechanics. And yet everyone treats them like gods on this earth, and so they kind of absorb that. And they, because of the training, I mean, this is true of a lot of people in the medical profession, but especially at the summit of the you know, heart surgery or brain surgery, they have to train so much, and they become so isolated from the rest of life that they're often very, very poorly cultured people. They're not really, you know, up to speed. Like, the last record they heard was like a Steely Dan record that came out in 1975. And they still think it's really good. And so I wanted to write about a kind of a jerk brain surgeon who's nevertheless on this pedestal for this character. He's the only person who can save him. And so you can begin to see the elements coming together. Now, so there I've got those plates spinning. Let me move over to this side of the stage. So I was beginning to approach a sense that I had a book or some of the primary elements of the book. And I was, at that moment, I'd accepted a fellowship from the American Academy in Berlin. So I was moving myself and my family for a wonderful sabbatical visit to Berlin, to this extraordinary privileged atmosphere in this place that was new to me. I mean, I passed through, but to live there for 6 months was really going to be something. And because it was sabbatical and I'd kind of cleared things out to an unusual degree, I decided to read for a few months before I began writing. And I started rereading things partly it was just the kind of books in English that I could find in bookstores in Berlin. Maybe it was some instinct or some appetite in me circling around, but I began rereading a lot of Graham Greene, which I'd read as a teenager and which was so formative for me. So here I have like the Cronenberg stuff circling around, and I'm thinking a little bit about Berkeley, and I'm thinking a lot about surgery, but I started reading these novels of expatriates and the kind of Graham Greene character who's this often this sort of half-ruined, expatriate, very isolated, kind of a womanizer but always alone, and a very romantic figure who's also sort of crushed. And usually what happens in the course of the Graham Greene novel is their lives are exposed, that their conceits, their last shreds of dignity are taken away from them. And I began to think how much I revered this kind of archetype. And I thought, my character's going to be one of these Graham Greene characters, and I'm going to use the expatriate image. I'm in Berlin. Let me write about where I am. Let me just grab onto this stuff that's so amazing and vivid to me, these impressions of what it was like to be an American in Berlin, and make that my guy. So those plates are spinning. Gambling. I forgot to say anything about gambling. Well, I've always loved narratives about gamblers. And, I also have a little bit of a... I'm not a high roller, and I've never really, blown the mortgage or anything. But I, as my friend Cobra's here to testify, I like to get into a regular poker game with, other low rollers like myself and take their money when I can. And I often do take Cobra's money. And I also really love stories built around the image of the gambler. I mean, beginning, of course, with Dostoevsky's novella, which you guys are specialists in the novella here. Well, when I was a teenage reader and I was omnivorous and I wanted to understand everything that was interesting, I heard about Dostoevsky and I was like, I'm going to tackle this guy. And then I looked at those massive books and all the unmemorizable names, and I saw that there was this one novella, and I was like, I'm reading that one. So I read The Gambler. That was my first taste of Dostoevsky. And in some ways, it's a very Graham Greene kind of tone, the lonely man, ruining himself in a city alone. I went on to read other Dostoevsky, but that was still a very emblematic book for me. And then some writers I love a lot, a little less canonical than Dostoevsky, but Walter Tevis, who wrote The Hustler, which was turned into the Paul Newman movie, terrific American film. But the book is very good, too. He is a writer I really love. And Don Carpenter, this kind of lost California writer who writes really vividly about pool hustlers and also about poker games. In a number of his books, and I started to think, I'm going to do a gambling story. I mean, it's such a simple motif in fiction because you've got automatic stakes and you've got automatic suspense. Are they going to ruin themselves or do they have like one more shred of luck in them? There's a great Robert Altman movie called California Split with Elliot Gould and who's the other plays the George Segal, thank you. And it's my favorite Altman movie. It's just a brilliant, very tight one for him. Brilliant story very atmospheric and funny. But the gambling scenes are, you're always on the edge of your seat automatically. So I thought, I'll take some of that mojo. That works. I'll put that in. So my guy was going to be a gambler. Of course, my first thought was poker, and then I shied from it instantly because I realized that poker was too suffused into the culture. There were too many images of poker on television and everywhere, and it just seemed very wrung out,
right.
Overfamiliar. And even though I play it, I didn't feel like the narrative juice was there. It didn't have that oddness or mystery. Mm-hmm. And then, there's so many things that go into like starting a novel. I learned that a kid I'd grown up with, the younger brother of one of my best friends, had spent a large part of his adult life in Southeast Asia, making a living as an expatriate backgammon hustler. And I was like, zing.
Perfect.
This is it. And I, because I knew this kid, and he seemed like a very troubled kid when we were in Brooklyn together, and I didn't know a lot about him. It was perfect because all my projections, I could identify with him without really having any knowledge. And I didn't, it's not like I went and sought him out or asked him permission or interviewed him. I just projected my Graham Greene figure into this idea of the expatriate American backgammon hustler who would be of my generation. And therefore, what entered into it as well was some of the ambivalence that I've exhibited in so many different books about coming from the atmosphere of the 60s, where my parents were very much parts of the counterculture, and the counterculture was all around me, and I identified with it enormously, but also I felt its richness. I also felt its precarity as a child, how much it was an unsafe environment, and also how it was doomed, how it was running into, you know, by the early 70s, it was kind of running its course, and it was going to become embittered and exhausted in certain ways. And so I have this tormented, you know, unresolved identification with hippies and with the 60s. And when I, you know, when I moved to Berkeley in my 20s, one of the weird things for me was it was like I'd done a reset on the clock, because that town is a place where the 60s kind of never ended. It was like I'd moved back into my own cultural past. I was like in my parents' world, whereas the rest of the world had gone into the Reagan 80s. Berkeley was still there for me to kind of, you know, feel ambivalent about up close and personal. Mm. It was no longer just a remote idea. It was like, wasn't like, oh, I remember this. It was like, it's all around me again. People's Park is right there. And it's a town that hasn't solved that, you know, how it feels about that stuff. So suddenly you can see all these things. I'm in Berlin. And so I began to think, okay, I'm not going to make this kid from Brooklyn, because first of all, I don't want to open the whole Brooklyn box. And then it's too close to that kid anyway. But I'm interested in having him be someone whose pretenses, his whole disguise, the surface that he's arranged for himself, is a fantasy. And what a mask or a fantasy covers up is something else. Well, if he's really into being a Graham Greene figure, if he really wants to kind of be that guy in a white tuxedo in a James Bond film, you know, gambling and drinking a martini, well, what is he? Why is that pretense important? It's important because he comes from a background like mine, where the 60s and the kind of let it all hang out stuff makes him so anxious. I mean, much more anxious than it made and makes me, that he's trying to run from it for the rest of his life. And suddenly, Berkeley was terrifically useful. And so this other plate that I've left spinning over here, I was like, finally, I'm going to use Berkeley. This kid grows up in the People's Park atmosphere.
Right.
And all of this, his kabuki of being like a Graham Greene character or like a James Bond, a minor character in a James Bond casino scene, you know, the guy in the white tuxedo who just can't stop winning at backgammon, this will all be because he's trying to not remember that he grew up in a fascinating but really precarious, squalid kind of hippie commune atmosphere. And his mother, in fact, was, you know, sat at the feet of a guru and then ran away from the guru and became a homeless person with a shopping cart. And I thought, he's going to be so Berkeley, and he's going to be so in denial of how Berkeley he is. And this, now I have it. I was like, this is my book. And so I just, so then I had a structural idea as well. Have you ever had so much talk after asking just one question?
No, this is amazing.
Okay, so there was a structural idea that had always fascinated me too. And I never used it to the extent that it interested me. This structural idea is the book that is cleaved into by a disaster. Mm. Okay, and the example that almost anyone will recognize is Don DeLillo's White Noise, where there's a before and there's an after, and in the middle, there's that section on the ecological catastrophe that changes their town and changes their family forever. And that's a thin section in the middle of the book, but after it, everything from the front section is completely altered. And Ian McEwan has written two novels that I think take this shape as well. One is a surgical book that many people have read called Saturday. But the one I like even better is a book of his that's less well-known anymore, although I think it's one of his greatest achievements. It's called The Innocent. And it's a book about Berlin, oddly enough, during the early construction of the wall, or actually just before the construction of the wall, when there's a tunnel running from the American sector to the Russian sector where spies pass back and forth. And this, the characters in the first half of the book are involved in espionage, but they're very innocent characters. And then in the middle of the book, they have to kill somebody to keep their secret, that they're lovers. And there's an extended sequence in the middle of The Innocent where the two of them, neither of them having done anything violent before in their life, have to rigorously saw up a corpse in order to hide it. And McEwen walks you through every step of it, and they're doing it together, and their arms are up to, you know, they're up to their elbows in gore, and the two of them are so in love, and you're so rooting for them in the first half of the book, but it's kind of like the disaster in the DeLillo book. By the second half, they're no longer innocent, and everything's changed. Just doing this, disassembling this corpse destroys their innocence. And I thought, this is going to be how my book is going to work. It's going to have that partition. DeLillo actually uses the structure once earlier as well. He uses it in End Zone, which is a book about college football, and the entire first half of the book is the build-up to the big game, which is described as if it's a war scene in the middle of the book, and then the entire second half of the book is aftermath. It's all broken bones and demoralized characters, and you know, there's nothing could ever be the same after the big game. So I was going to write a book that had this structural idea, and you know, in some ways I used that notion in The Fortress of Solitude. Because the liner note divides is a thin section dividing two leaves, two large halves, and the liner note contains the murder, you know, by this character Mingus of his own grandfather. So it's a kind of a disaster from which the book can never recover. And so there's a before and after. But I thought I'm going to use this a little more like the way McEwen used it in The Innocent. I'm going to make the reader go through a kind of a physical experience of bodies being taken apart that you will never feel the same after you've read it. That was my goal, you know?
You achieved it.
It's the Cronenberg sequence is in the middle of the book, and it's sort of like, whoa, I hadn't bargained for this. Mm-hmm. And then you have to, with the character, you have to survive what's left. You know, what remains of this character, what remains of the book in the aftermath of this catastrophe?
Well, it's interesting, too, because in the scene that you're describing is the only time you're taking on somebody else's point of view. And, I mean, without giving too much away, like, you brilliantly have a different voice, completely different voice of this doctor, Beringer, and how he performs this very horrific technical surgery.
Right, well, and you know, I mean, I wanted the horror to be not only your physical, you know, crisis of having to read what he's doing to the face of the main characters. It's almost as if he's taking the book apart, because the book has only been this guy to this point. But also, it's everyone's worst-case scenario of what your godlike, superhuman, surgical, you know, caretaker would be like, because he just doesn't even remember the guy's name who he's operating on. He's so disassociated. It's pure meat to him. Mm-hmm. It's just meat. And he just has there's no holistic interest in the human being that he's reworking whatsoever. So, and I wanted to force that confrontation into the reader's experience.
All right, so you have all these plates spinning. And you have your construction kind of outline. What is the first thing that you put pen to paper with or put on a screen? Do you just go into writing, or do you start breaking down characters? I mean, your characters are very unique and distinct in everything that you do. Is that something that you start with, of like coming up with how they look, how they talk?
I don't do like character studies or, I mean, I'll step back and put this in an even broader framework. I don't like to write other than for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have like sheafs of, you know, outlines or narrative, you know, studies or character studies or atmosphere sketches. I take the most minimal notes I can, just like jottings that if you looked at them, they'd be just like post-its effectively, that just help me remember things I want to not forget, particulars. But no, what I do after I'm at that moment when all the plates are spinning, I'm like, oh, that is a book. I go right at page one and I begin writing, because I want to prove it on the page. Mm-hmm. It's no use to me if I write some sort of 10-page character study and I'm like, that's a wonderful character. It hasn't done anything yet.
Yeah.
It has to be proven in the matrix of, you know, a scenario, a situation, an atmosphere, there has to be a dynamics of plot, and there has to be a compulsion to experience what comes next. I want to, in a sense, be, as much as I can, writing it, a proxy for the reader. I want to be wondering and discovering what happens at that same, well, it can't be at the same rate, God help me, I'd love to be able to write as fast as I read, but in the same, essentially in the same mode of discovery, page by page, every day until the compulsion is satisfied. And so I can never see any reason to write anything out of sequence, because then I might as well just do a jump cut to that sequence. If I've understood what comes next to such a degree that I can jump, then I'll just jump. But I don't want to write some later portion of the book and then have to figure out how the reader would experience them. I want to be, as much as I can, situated in the reader's position in regards to the story.
So how far ahead do you see while you're writing? Like, how many steps ahead are you, okay, well, I know at some point this is going to come up and I need to get to this?
It really varies according to the book, and sometimes also is different according to the scale of the book. I mean, this is like sort of a medium-sized novel for me. What's typical is that I have to have some very strong image, usually a few very strong images or set pieces of where I want to land at the end. So the end image has to be something I'm writing toward the entire time.
So then are you surprised? Are you allowed
to
surprise yourself?
Oh, there are so many surprises on the way. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, when I say the end image is in view, that's like driving and you can see the snowy mountaintop. There's lots of dark between, you know, the road. I mean, there's this famous image, I can't remember whose it is anymore, of, you know, it's like driving at night and you just see as far as your headlamps light up. But along with what your headlamps light up, there may be some glow in the distance that you're pointed at. But, you know, planning, the map is not the territory. Planning a book and even having very definite schemes, a novel is so extensive. There's so many sentences, there's so many images, so many turns of phrase. A character has to do so much, so behave so much, and speak so much. Many characters have to do this. Of course, there's a thousand surprises lying in wait for every planned moment that you've got. The plans often become quite amusing in retrospect because you think you find so many surprises. Things are so different by the time you get to them that you look at the plan and you're like, "That was what got me here," you know, thinking I would write this thing. And one of the interesting experiences I've had a few times is something I'll think is a big payoff that I'm waiting, you know, it's often the goal, the thing that drives me in the writing is I do have some late in the book, near the end, kind of thing I want to see, I want to write. I'm, you know, at some point, I can't remember exactly when it was. Oh, there's another plate I haven't gotten spinning for you yet is the fast food.
Oh yeah,
okay,
right.
We'll talk about the fast food, but
sliders.
I knew I wanted, once I had a backgammon book, the surrealism in my brain took over, and I was like, I want to see a meat backgammon game. I want there to be burgers oozing, dripping on a grill that are also the pieces in a backgammon game. And the idea that there would be a climactic scene, a very important, consequential scene where two people were urgently playing meat backgammon was the driver. I was like, I've got to arrange a book so that I can actually have that be a big payoff scene, because No one except me will ever have thought of that, and it's now my duty to bring it into being. You know, it was kind of like when I, you know, in Motherless Brooklyn, when I thought about having a guy with Tourette's trying to sit at a Zendo. You know, I'm like, there's a scene to arrange a whole book toward. But there are times when I'll have something like that I think is going to be a big payoff, and actually, by the time I get there, aspects of its payload or features of its interest have been exhausted in the buildup, and I get there and it's just a kind of a tiny moment.
Right.
I can't remember the example now, but there was something in The Fortress of Solitude that I thought I was writing the whole book toward, and it actually becomes a kind of an afterthought gesture by the time I get there, because other things on the journey explored and satisfied and consummated those images and those ideas so totally that by the time I got there, all I had to do was say that it had happened. It was not a big set piece.
Now let's talk a little bit about research, because you think a half dozen doctors at the end of the game.
There's a joke in there. So I think there are, well, you've got the book here.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, let's look at it. So I think there, how many people do I thank in this list? 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So there's 8 people thanked at the end of the book. The first 3 are actual MDs, one of whom is a brain surgeon. And then the 4th, Dr. Lawrence Rickles, is just a PhD. And then there's Atul Gawande, and I'm going to tell you a story about him. So he's a real doctor and a real surgeon. And then I had my German editor and my friend Chris Offutt, as a novelist, and my wife to thank. But once I had like 5 doctors in a row, I just put a doctor in front of my wife's name and Chris's name. And so, it's amazing how, you know, even though you're a fiction writer, people will see they will absolutely believe the acknowledgments page. So everyone's like, 8 doctors, he really worked hard on that. But I just started calling everyone a doctor. When I was underway, this is just a good story if you know this book. I'm sorry, bear with me if you don't know the book. But when I was underway, I went to the Sydney Writers Festival in Australia, and Atul Gawande was there. Guy wrote Being Mortal. He writes about medical matters for The New Yorker. He's a very graceful writer, and it turns out an extraordinarily fine human being, really, really warm and a great reader, and he flattered me. He was very interested in He'd read all my work, and he was very interested in what I was doing. And I said, "Well, actually, I'm writing about surgery, and I had a question that was just coming to mind for me, which was about, you know, my asshole surgeon. And the question was, what is the way that doctors relate to their nurses when they don't want to have to talk to them?" And they just want them to be servile.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, you blast music. You get, you know. And in fact, if you blast the right music in the, because you if you're the surgeon, you get to play the music. If you, you know." And he started telling the story, and he was remembering something. It seemed to me very compelling to him, which was, he said, "Oh yeah, there was this brain surgeon I knew who used to play really, really loud heavy metal in the." Operating theater, because he didn't like to have old nurses around. He wanted only young ones around. It's really, and I was like, that's my guy. That's so right. So so I wrote the book with this sequence where he blasts Jimi Hendrix all the time
for
14
hours.
Operating.
Yeah.
And everyone just throws up their hands. It's like he's the dude. He gets to do what he wants. And I sent the book to Atul Gawande, and I said, "You've got I've given you an acknowledgement in the book because you gave me this wonderful detail about the surgeon blasting Jimi Hendrix in the operating room." And Gawande wrote back and said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I never said any such thing." Which means, I don't know, it means either he suddenly realized that the guy who he was talking about was maybe going to read the book and he wanted some, like, a no paper trail, or else I made it up and I attributed it to Gawande, or I'm lying to you right now. I'm not sure which it is, but it's mysterious to me, and I haven't confronted him on it about why he suddenly went into denial.
But there obviously has to be a lot of research. I mean, the surgery scene alone.
The interesting thing about the surgery scene. So the thing about the surgeons is, as soulless as I may be suggesting some of them are, they are also makers of narrative, because what they have to do afterwards, after a major, well, after almost any procedure, is dictate, probably to someone who's jotting it all down, what they did, blow by blow, every move, for accountability. And then I did this, and then I, and they actually, the result of an epic brain surgery like the one in my book is like a 15-page, single-spaced narrative.
Wow.
saying what every decision and maneuver was. And then I left this amount of matter because I didn't think I could, I was afraid of nicking this vein, and so I closed up there and I moved over here and I cauterized this. They actually say everything that they do. And it goes into a, and it, you know, it, in one sense it's vastly boring, but suddenly for me it was totally arresting because it was like, this is the brain of the meat, manipulator that I need. I want to know how they think of it, and it is all technical.
What about backgammon?
Well, I played a lot online. I didn't get good enough to, I think, be a backgammon hustler, but
yeah.
I got just good enough playing online that I could really annoy people who I will never meet, who were like awake at night looking for a game, and I would beat them routinely online. And I was like, okay, I'm starting to figure out enough. I read books of backgammon theory, and I mean, the interesting thing about backgammon, so of course I was attracted to it because it's peculiar, and I also played it as a kid in the 70s. My friend Joel and I would go home, we were like latchkey kids, and we'd go home in Brooklyn to his house and, you know, raid his refrigerator and play backgammon all afternoon. What I didn't know, couldn't have known at the time, was I was participating in a cultural moment. Backgammon is simultaneously one of the most ancient human games. It's played in, like, you know, Mesopotamia in some form. It's really, really ancient. But it also lurks. It's always been sort of just, you know, that other game, until it has, for really no clear accountable reason, a kind of crescendo, and there's a giant backgammon craze precisely in the 1970s, which is why, if you have associations for it, many of them are sort of like corny and embarrassing. Like, you can picture like photographs of sophisticated men at the Playboy Mansion with like a half-dressed woman near the fireplace and a really like weird, colorful beverage, you know, a dark malt scotch or a you know,
cognac,
a grasshopper,
yeah,
or something, and they're studying, they're in their suits and ties, and they're studying, and they've got their, you know, dry look haircuts, and they're studying a open backgammon problem. Well, the reason it's got these associations, these sort of slightly cheesy, you know, 1970s associations, was that there was a crazy worldwide fascination with backgammon that reached a pitch building through the 60s, and in the 70s, everybody was playing it. And that's why, if you go to, like, you know, your uncle's, you know, guest room, there's always a backgammon set kind of sitting there. It was like the thing. And it still has, you know, like anything, the internet now proves there's always a constituency for everything, right? For dressing up in different costumes and doing whatever. There's a huge backgammon world, and there are people who play it competitively, and there's tournament backgammon, and there's also a large backgammon gambling world. The two things are parallel, and some people will try to master both worlds, but even the rules are even slightly different for how you bet. There's some variations. You know, club backgammon, they call it, if you're gambling, has slightly different gambling rules than if you're playing it in a tournament. So it seems so great because it's so cheesy and awkward, and at the same time, it has this ancient archetypal quality. You can kind of feel that it belongs outside of cultural space and time, that, you know, it's it doesn't, It wasn't anyone's sole possession, let's put it that way. It wasn't like having Monopoly be the game. And, you know, games are interesting because, especially games where people gamble, because they're a kind of a closed system. They're a world where you can enact stakes without, you know, it's like everything matters and nothing matters. It's not life or death, but it feels like it. You know, while you're at the all-night poker game, there is nothing but that poker game. And you can live or die there. And it can destroy you, but you'll get up the next day and you're fine. So it's like a kind of a theater of human commitment and intensity, but it evaporates, you know, the moment you step away from it.
Now, there's another element, there's another plate that we didn't talk about, telepathy.
Right, yeah. So this is my tendency towards overload, right? So I was also thinking about, again, the depth and surface. One of the things that seemed funny to me about this character was he's really, you know, the problem for him in Berkeley, the problem with his mother's milieu, is that everyone's always invading his brain space. He wants to just push people out. Everything's too touchy-feely. Everything's too, you know, the guru is always trying to read his thoughts. So what if this guy who wants nothing to do with anything except like coolly, smoothly passing through life has the problem of hearing other people's thoughts or thinks he does? And I really got into the idea of keeping the that fantastic element at the almost subliminal level.
Sure.
Where it's like a Twilight Zone episode where you could interpret every event in the story as strictly realistic, but there's a whisper or a delusion of a possible, you know, supernatural element. I mean, it's also like Henry James' Turn of the Screw, that, you know, it's like a homeopathic tincture of the uncanny or the fantastic, which I wanted to introduce into the book. Also to raise that feeling of the book being about a character in the present, but also having this archetypal horror story. You know, I feel really reluctant saying horror because it's a genre with such extraordinarily committed readers and writers, and I don't think this book registers according to the contemporary framework of what a horror novel is. I mean, it's really not either scary or gory, and the standards for like what's scary and or how much blood and guts there are. I mean, it's like a literary novel that, in my mind, generates out of a desire to have written a horror novel, but it wouldn't fit.
Sure.
I don't think I'm playing that game by the rules.
Now let's talk a little bit about, so you have everything out, you've written your book. Talk a little bit about your editing process and how that works with this book specifically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this book was a charmed one. I wrote it with a real sense of enjoyment, and I mean, I hadn't written a story that was as driven by the narrative itself. And, you know, when I say that I was circling back to Graham Greene, the preceding couple of novels were not narratively shapely books. They were big, encompassing, crazy books with lots of different voices and set pieces and trap doors and time shifts. And even though this book has that one punched out section in the middle where you get the surgeon's point of view, it's basically my main character's close third person straight through. And there are some flashbacks, but no major structural jumps in terms of time. So apart from the geographical movement, you know, Berkeley, Singapore, Berlin, it's really a tale. And the pleasure of engaging with that as the writer is the tale wants to be told. You know, it's like it's got that nice, you know, what happens next, just that energy just driving it without my other kinds of plans, the kinds of plans that make, you know, both Chronic City and Distant Gardens such ungainly. You know, I'm very proud of those books, and I think they have a lot to offer, but what they don't do is simply tell their tale. They do everything else. They interrupt their tale and shift it and turn it around so you can look at it from the back and figure out how it's working. And, you know, this book was going to stay, in some sense, a little more obedient to that model that I absorbed as a teenage reader, reading, you know, well, not just Graham Greene, but reading Raymond Chandler or, you know, or a lot of the science fiction I was reading at around that time, or reading a short Dostoevsky novel like The Gambler. It was going to stay with its character and watch him descend through this series of catastrophes. And so I was jacked up on the narrative fun of that. And so I got the book I wanted to in my draft, and it needed only ordinary kinds of adjustments and correction and cleaning up. There were no major interventions that I did after the fact. The thing that bedeviled me the most, and that I may not have ever gotten completely right, was how to impart what I wanted to impart to the reader about the ESP element. Because I really love indeterminacy at a certain level, but I think it just, some readers are really disabled by is that thing,
is
the
it real? Yeah.
Is the character yeah. just imagining this, or is it real? And I wanted, I was committed to it this time. I knew that I was going to play with that indeterminacy thing, and that probably some readers would just not be aboard. It's fine. Nothing's for everyone. That's cool. But I wanted it to work just right, so that the people who stood a chance of enjoying that would really get it. And it was the hardest thing. So I was tinkering with that to the last second, with how to describe his attempts to read other people's minds, or his attempts to stop hearing voices. And that was hard.
Now, I want to use characters, and I apologize for anyone who's not familiar with the book. I want to use characters. I'm going to use Plybon, who is your grill master, who everything is done the same way every time to create the same effect. Then you have Dr. Beringer, who is kind of, he is a master at his art, but it is, when he does it, it's his way, and he has the outline and sees how it's done. And then you have Bruno, Alexander Bruno, who's your main character, who plays his game, and he sees the structure of the game, and he has a plan, but his plan can change. As a writer, after writing all of your books, which character do you identify the
great.
Most with?
That's great. Well, no, I mean, actually, you just walked me up to something that's so nice. It seems like I would have come to this much, much sooner. That, the thing that characterizes backgammon that became fascinating to me, and that I have Bruno celebrate privately, because he's not interested in impressing anyone else, but is that with backgammon, the rules are very simple, but the situations are infinitely complex, and it doesn't work to have a philosophy. You have to have all the philosophies and use the one that is appropriate in a given moment. So the dice change the game every time they roll, and you have to be able to say, okay, this calls for, a running game, or this calls for a back game. It's very novelistic in that sense, that once you have set up the elements, they're going to reveal new faces constantly. If they have any real energy, if you've invested them with enough of the lifelike, peculiarities and intensities, they're going to keep changing, because you're going to commit to one scene, and then it's like rolling the dice. It makes a new board for you. So every day that you're writing the novel, you kind of have to have not a single philosophy or set of rules, but figure out which one is going to get me out of the next situation, which one is going to solve the next problem. It's an endless series of new looks, new decisions. It's a great contrast you've drawn, right? So the burger element, so there's this guy who is the grill master at a small slider joint, and he's constantly making sliders, and there's just only one, like you said, there's only one way to do it right. And at the same time, he's an anarchist, and so he's got this sort of old school devotion to craft, but he believes in chaos. And I hadn't really thought of this as a kind of a series of different, the surgeon is closer to backgammon. When you open up someone's head, it's like the dice rolled in the biggest possible sense. You're going to have to respond to what's there, and it will never match the scans. Nothing tells you what's in there until...
But he still has, his Jimi Hendrix, he has his salacious
right.
jokes
well, that's
at
what,
the end.
This is what consoles you when you are dealing with a world of indeterminacy is ritual, maybe even to the level of kabuki. You have a compensatory desire to play at control in a world that isn't really actually going to submit to your control. I think that's what's going on. So if you're all you're doing is making sliders, you can afford to be an anarchist. If you are actually operating on neural tissue, you'd better be a kind of a super structuralist.
I love this book, obviously, and this
thank
is
you.
Why I'm taking this
thank
approach.
You. Yeah.
Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time.
This was great. This was a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. And thank you all for joining us tonight.